Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Bergen, New Jersey. We're here to bring you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us on restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Hi there, Mark.
Hi, Francis.
How are you?
Great. How are you doing today?
I'm great, but I didn't just go to Washington with my family to watch the cherry blossoms that, due to the bad weather, happened.
Not bad weather, due to the great
weather. Due to the different weather.
We were a month too late for
it. Yeah, it was spectacular.
That was a lot of fun.
How were the cherry leaves?
Okay, I will tell you, there was one tree in National Stadium that still had, like, 9 cherry blossoms on it.
The Department of Homeland Security has been icing down that tree for the last two months.
I saw, like, 9 cherry blossoms while I was there. New Brunswick has a ton of Japanese cherry blossoms. It's a very beautiful city to see the cherry blossoms, but it happened a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
Everything's
a little ahead of schedule.
Everything's way ahead.
We were talking to the chef whose father is out in Pittsburgh, and he said that they had a killing frost. So they had the trees blossomed, and then they had a killing frost. Bad for the trees.
Tree fruits. The things that are going to have trouble this year are the tree fruits. You're certainly going to see any of those northerly tree fruits, apples, pears, things that tend to grow in the cooler climates are going to have trouble this year.
Well, I don't know. You know, if you're not in a place that had a killing frost after blossom, you might be fine.
Yeah, but even here in New Jersey, we had some farmers who were setting fires in their fields.
But it worked here. Well, I think it's going to be variable. You might find in some climates that it's spectacular. It might be 2003 in Europe, you know.
Yeah, I think we're going to end up with a shortage of some of those tree fruits.
Dollar.
You're on.
Dollar. All right, dollar.
You're
everybody, on. Everybody in listener land knows.
Somebody in September dollar. Remind us that we made this bet.
Yeah, exactly. It's on record. It's recorded.
So while I was down there, I stayed with some friends. And by the way, you know how you know that somebody is really friends with you?
Yeah.
They invite you, your wife, and your 4 children to stay in their place.
Oh, I've never done that.
That's how you know somebody's really friends with you. Anyway, one of the people we were staying with is ex-military. So he gave me an MRE. You know what an MRE is?
Yeah, it's a meals ready to eat.
Meal ready to eat.
And he's a friend, you said?
And he said, you know, why don't you give a try to what our military's eating? So this is a very kind of complicated packet, much more complicated than I would expect it to be. Frankly, I would have expected that you open it up, there's a granola bar and, you know, some protein of some sort, and you're on your way.
You don't watch war movies a lot, do you? That's because they've been in a couple of films, like guys preparing MREs. But go ahead, tell us a story.
Okay, so basically what you have in this pouch, which is obviously a watertight pouch, you tear it open, is there's various things. Okay, there's a little thing of Tabasco sauce and salt and pepper and a spork, and you know those types of things, a napkin and a handy wipe. But there's a really cool device. It's really, I mean, honestly, it's a very well thought out, system that they've created.
Mm-hmm.
And in there, so there's an entree, there's some type of, I guess, fruit, component, which I think is in there. And from talking to people in the military, very important, obviously, to maintain your calories when you're in the field.
Right.
You use up a lot every day and you need to replenish them. So there was a thing called berry cobbler in there, which was in a pouch, obviously. There was a way to make coffee. There was a way to make a fruit punch. And the meal I had was spaghetti and meat sauce.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. You're looking at me like
I've had canned spaghetti.
Okay, pouched.
Dry.
Is it
wet or dry?
It is wet. Not wet, like
gooshy.
Super wet.
Gooshy.
But
gooshy.
So what you do is you take this activator, this heat activator, you immerse, you put water in the bag, you put this heat activator in the bag, then you put the pouch of
spaghetti,
macaroni and meat sauce in. Okay, and the pouch activates and gets hot, and eventually you'll make your coffee with that same pouch. And it heats up this spaghetti meat sauce thing to a kind of almost room temperature.
Oh.
Okay.
It doesn't get hot.
So, not mine didn't. Maybe I did it wrong.
All right.
You know, somebody said, maybe you used too much water. But I don't think it ever gets hot.
Okay.
I think hot's out of the realm of where this goes. So, on a scale of 1 to disgusting, it was a 1.
Really?
Yeah, it was awful. Just if you said to me, you can have this thing again, or you can have a can of SpaghettiOs cold, I would have a can of SpaghettiOs cold. Okay, it had that smell, and I'll tell you the smell that it had. It smelled like the dog food can.
Yeah.
Okay.
SpaghettiOs does too, though.
Yeah. So awful. Just absolutely awful.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, okay, well, the berry cobbler's got to be good. It's in a pouch. You know, a tasty cake can make a berry cobbler that can last for forever, right?
Right.
So what I will say is it was very berry-y, and I'm sure that was to get
a lot of fruit, some fruit in there. And sugars.
Well, they're working a lot to give balanced diets, to make sure all the vitamin groups are hit. There's a lot of study done to make sure that these meals are complete. And one of the things that it says on the pouch is you need to eat the entire thing.
Right.
When you're out in the field. You can't just pick and choose. You can't trade your cobbler for somebody else's spaghetti and meat sauce.
Right.
You know, you need to be balanced, and you need to make sure you get all your calories. So the cobbler... is just a mush bag of berries and what tastes like uncooked pastry dough.
Yeah.
And it's horrible. On a scale of 1 to disgusting, it is a 2.
Mm.
Okay? Also in the bag is...
I think you mean on a scale of disgusting to 10.
No, I mean on a scale of 1 to disgusting. We didn't even get to above disgusting.
Oh, really?
Yes, really.
We're below disgusting.
We are below disgusting.
Wow.
So, the next thing, there's a fruit punch in there. But the fruit punch that I make with this water is not the quality of Kool-Aid.
Really?
Okay, it's below Kool-Aid. It's you know, we used to, when I was a young kid and we were wrestling or whatever, or playing football, we would go to, like, the Krausers or the 7-Eleven or whatever, and they would have really cheap, like, juice products that were basically just sugar and water.
And coloring. Yeah.
And we used to call them bug juice.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
And, you know, we'd share, you know, 5 of us would share a gallon of it after practice to rehydrate. And this was not that good.
Really?
This was less good than that.
Really?
Really. And again, this is a pouch. So I'm sitting here and I'm saying, you know, you invested all this money. I mean, it's got to be very expensive to dehydrate, to put this activator in here, to seal all this. This is not an inexpensive process. There's also... lots of thought going into these meals.
Right. To deliver the nutrition.
The nutrition's got to be there. The balance has to be there. The calorie content has to be there. The vitamins have to be there. It's all got to be in there, and it's got to be in balance, and each of these things have to play off each other. Why's it got to taste so bad?
Because
they put a lot of effort into making it a product that is usual. Why does our military have to eat food that tastes so bad?
Because it's a captive audience, and because there's a lot of money to be made, you know. And it's this, for the same reason school lunch program is so bad. And look, I'm not one of those guys that says, oh, government can't do anything and government is bad at everything. I disagree. I think the government gets a lot of good stuff done.
See, I think they're spending a lot of money on these MREs already.
I agree, but what I'm saying is, and they're spending a lot of money on the school lunch program too. I mean, not necessarily per meal, but there's a lot of money that goes to the private sector and a lot of profit is made. Well, if you have... if no one cares about taste and no one cares about the person eating it at the end, and, you know, and I would wonder how nutritionally balanced that is. I would think that there would be a greater concern, sadly, in making sure that the military in the field has the right nutritional balance, because if they don't, in a relatively short period of time, you're going to pay the price organizationally for not having soldiers with a sufficient calorie count.
I'm
going to
tell you, my only thought was maybe there's some value into somebody
toughing
in battle, not just toughing it out, somebody in battle not caring about his food, not
maybe?
You know, just being sustenance for him, that they're not being,
maybe?
You know, that not being something that's good in any way other than nutrition and to fuel.
Maybe. And, you know, I don't know that that's the case, but I do know that, you know, when you have the school lunch program and no one is advocating for the kids and no one
who cares about food is involved in the process. You get, you know, a certain number of dollars goes to the people who are the purveyors and of the food in the private sector. And if they can get more dollars by substituting pink slime in for ground beef, they will put pink slime in rather than the ground beef. Whereas you would never do that.
Right.
You know, whereas if you were in the field and you cared that the troops got good and wholesome food and, you know, look, these guys are putting their lives on the line out in the field for us. I don't imagine that, you know, it's on purpose that we want them to have food that's disgusting. But I've heard from so many soldiers that it is. And you know what?
And that's the other thing, too. So I began asking around. When I came back from D.C., I began asking people, and they're like, oh, yeah, they're awful. You know, there's – and Lou, our partner, was in the Army for a long time. He's like, actually, the eggs and ham. I like the eggs and ham. I was an officer, so I got to go through all the MREs. I take all the eggs and ham because I like that one. So it's kind of amusing.
You know, it goes back a long way, though. The food technology and the delivery technology and the heating technology is there now that wasn't there a long time ago.
I guess that's my point. We could make something.
I can't imagine we couldn't make it tasty.
For
10% more expense, we couldn't make it.
You know, looking at it, Francis, what I looked at was, I don't think it needs to be more expensive to be more tasty in this case.
You know, though, it's funny. You and I think that, but trust me, they all
right.
It's cheaper.
And 2 cents a portion is something I would discount and not even consider.
Right.
And 2 cents a portion to every person in the military for a year for every meal
adds up to
a lot of money.
You know, and how armies have eaten has always been, has always been an issue to the health of the army and the strength of the army and supply lines and the like. I had an MRE once, except it wasn't really an MRE. It was what they called C rations. My dad had brought home some C rations when he was discharged from the Marines after World War II. I was born in 65. Sometime in the late 70s, we cracked open that can because he wanted me to see what was in it.
Oh, my goodness.
It was probably it was a metal sealed can. It was probably the size of a bowling bag, and it was a meal for probably four people. And obviously, it had all deteriorated by then, and it was pretty gross. It was pretty.
You didn't eat any.
I did not. No. Too old.
You scared the lights out.
No. But there was. You could have chipped beef, and we weren't allowed to have chipped beef in the house. By the way, did you know that? My mom
mentioned
liked
that
it.
To me.
Never allowed. Not allowed in the house unless my dad was at work.
You know, and I really do think that we're doing a disservice to the military in the way we're feeding them. If this is really, and listen, MREs, I've heard it from enough people that this is what you get in the field. We can do better than that.
I agree.
And so Francis, I told Francis we were going to talk about MREs today during the show. And so we came up with an idea that hopefully in one tiny little part will make it up to you guys. If you have a military ID card and you served in the United States military, come to stage left.
If you are active or if you are a veteran.
Active or a veteran. And you have to have had eaten at least one MRE by
compulsorily.
Force.
Yeah, exactly.
come to stage left on Sunday the 20th. Is that
Sunday the 20th of May 2012.
Okay. All right. That's a weekend. We're celebrating our 20th anniversary. Come to stage left and we will buy you a burger.
That's okay. It. That's right. Let's do over the whole weekend celebration on the 18th to the 20th of May. We are on the 18th of May. We are going
you
to
go over.
Go over.
Okay.
Yeah. On the 18th of May, we are celebrating our 20th anniversary. Stage Left will have been open on our street corner of downtown New Brunswick for 20 years as of the 22nd of May. So on the 18th, that's the Friday before, we're having a dinner. I think it's $79 a person. Mm-hmm. It's going to sell out. If you want to go to the dinner, email Francis at restaurantguysradio.com, and we'll try and get you in. We want to save some spots for listeners. It is a dinner with the four prior chefs of stage left and the current chef of stage left. Each chef is going to cook a different course. We're just going to sit down. You can, beverages isn't included. You can pick whatever you want, wine or beer or glass of water. I don't care. And Mark and Lou and I are going to be there, and that's going to be a ton of fun. But that following Sunday, here's how we're going to celebrate, by inviting any members of the United States military, until we run out, while supplies last, come on in and have one of our world-class burgers at Stage Left. That's on the corner of Livingston Avenue and George Street in downtown New Brunswick. Call us, let us know you're coming so we can be sure and set one aside and that you're coming for the
That's right. That's Sunday, May 20th.
Burger. Yeah.
So definitely come. We will, but definitely it's going to be limited space, so you have to let us know that you're coming. You need to make a reservation.
And the best way to do that is through email if you can. Francis@restaurantguysradio.com. And
don't be afraid. Listen, come with four bets and sit at a table for four.
Have four burgers.
You earned it. We're giving it away.
Yeah, I'm in. All right, well, listen, definitely reach out to us, and if you know somebody who's in the military and they haven't had a Stage Left burger yet, bring them by, and if you weren't in the military, you don't get one, but your buddy will. So hopefully we'll see a bunch of you then. We'll be back in just a moment. We're going to be talking with Sebastian Beckwith. He is one of the world's foremost experts, certainly one of America's foremost experts on tea, and we'll be talking with him in just a moment. So stick with us. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on RestaurantGuysRadio.com and the Heritage Radio Network.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, The Restaurant Guys, and we are here today with Sebastian Beckwith. He is a leading American tea authority based in New York. He offers tea seminars at New York's China Institute, the Institute of Culinary Education, and he is one of the importers of some of the best tea in America.
Sebastian, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on the show with you both.
Tea is something that is getting a lot more attention in fine dining, and it's really relevant to the restaurant business, especially on the high end. And it's also something that I think people have really come to realize as they get better and better taste across the board, that, you know, your American tea bag isn't exactly cutting it. And we're seeing tea in restaurants, on high-end restaurants across America, everything from very elaborate service to the basics of what one needs to be able to serve loose tea in a restaurant. But tea service is kind of complicated. Buying tea and becoming aware of the differences in tea is an acquired skill or an acquired taste, really, or an acquired expertise, certainly. What's going on with tea in America?
Well, I think that the restaurant industry and sort of America in general knows tea as tea culture, really, as a tea bag and a cup of lukewarm water with some milk and sugar, and you're good to go. In sort of the same way that people maybe knew wine out of a jug in the 1960s in this country. But if you travel to origin, you find a whole different story. You find teaware that's made as you found, fine glasses for wine, et cetera, in the places of origin to let you appreciate these products much more. And so I think that appreciation is, you know, riding the wave of wine, beer, all the food and ingredients that we look forward to eating now in the top restaurants around the country.
My grandmother used to go take me to the Bunny Hop restaurant in the Essex Green Shopping Center in West Orange, New Jersey. And even as a 10-year-old, I was embarrassed when she brought her own tea bag and ordered a cup of hot water to save herself 75 cents. But talk to us about, you know, I want to address, being the restaurant guys, the first thing is service of tea in a restaurant. When you're looking at high-quality teas, tea bags are basically, think of tea bags as sawdust as opposed to, you know, press board as opposed to things made of actual wood. But when you're dealing with loose tea, it's quite complicated. Coffee is dripped through a filter or comes out of an espresso machine. We bring it to the table.
Or French press.
And we're done with it. Whereas tea, the leaves need to infuse tableside, preferably, and then we need to dispose of those leaves. There are different water temperatures.
Tea can be sloppy in a restaurant, I think is what Francis is trying to get.
Or at the very least, a little bit complex. It adds a layer of complexity. How are your restaurants dealing with that?
I think they're doing better. We certainly do a lot of training. But I think it's also what you're used to. Tea for many restaurants is an afterthought. They're opening soon. Oh, we need some tea. And people are used to the ease of a tea bag. You know, that's what the culture is. And so I can make tea very easily with loose tea, and we train people that if you have a teapot with a basket strainer, you just put the loose tea in there. The customer pours their first cup, then the level of the water drops below the tea leaves so that the second cup isn't undrinkably strong. It's actually quite easy. They just need to pay attention to things like water temperature a little bit. You know, sort of either really hot, or for the green teas, a little lower water temperature is going to make a much better cup. And people are enjoying it quite a bit, I think.
You know, Sebastian, Francis and I stopped by your place yesterday and spent some time with you. And one of the things that I found most intriguing during our visit was just indeed how not hot, I guess, would be the best way to express it, some of the water that you made the green teas with was. And the black teas that we had were all made with very hot water. But some of the green teas were made with hot water, some were made with fairly hot water, and some were made with hot water that was not really all that hot at all. Can you talk to us a little about that?
Yeah, I mean, the black teas and some of the oolongs, you really need that hot water for the flavor to extract. But the green and the white teas are made up of the very delicate leaf buds, you know, picked in the spring. And if you put boiling water on them, you tend to cook them. You're going to bring out more tannins. You're going to get an unpleasant flavor. And if you make a much lower water temperature, it's more gentle on these leaves, and you'll get a much richer, fuller flavor. But again, this is part of the education. If someone has never tried green tea, they will, of course, put boiling water on it and then not like the flavor, understandably. So this is the education part. So this is what we're doing with the restaurant staff.
I have been to some very expensive restaurants and paid a lot for some green tea that, to me, it tasted like cooked vegetables. Mm-hmm. And I think there are a lot of folks that don't understand.
They get very grassy and almost asparagus-like.
They taste
sometimes.
Like cooked vegetables, which is what they are. And yesterday, when we had a great discussion of temperature of tea, and I hope this doesn't sound too boring on the air, but the teas that we had were really phenomenally interesting and complex, with a great deal of that kind of meaty umami that comes from green tea. And I was really just shocked, number one, by how great some of those teas were. And I'm also about how many restaurants, even good restaurants that invest a lot of money in tea, kind of get the green tea thing a little wrong. Well, a lot wrong, and serve tea that's maybe expensive but doesn't taste very good if you make it wrong.
I keep thinking of a specific restaurant that used to buy the most expensive Japanese gyokuro, which you would traditionally make with water at about 120 degrees, and it would just fill your mouth with an incredible umami flavor. They would make it with the boiling water. You'd lose everything. It would be bitter, tannic, almost undrinkable, but they would have the name on the menu, so that was good enough for them.
So if you were to buy retail a pound of that gyokuro, what would that cost you? What would that cost a consumer if they were able to find it in a shop and buy it retail?
I think ours is $300 a pound or $350 a pound.
So almost free.
Exactly. Let's do a quick little math thing here. If tea is $100 a pound and you're using 4 grams, which is sort of on the heavy side, that's 88 cents a serving. So, 75, 80, 88 cents a serving. So, Starbucks mocha latte is way more expensive than a serving of that gyokuro, with which you can use the leaves several times.
That brings us to a really interesting point. Let's talk about, in so many teas, my grandmother also used the Lipton tea bag that she brought many times and would sometimes go back into her purse for a second round of the bunny hop. But that really wasn't intended to be used more than once. My grandmother did grow up in the Depression, and that never left her. But these teas, and you brought us tea yesterday, one of the teas you brought us, it was its 15th infusion.
For those of our listeners who don't know exactly what an infusion is, basically you make a pot of tea from your leaves, then you pour all the water off and drink the tea. Then you make another pot of tea
off those same leaves.
That would be the second infusion. Then you could do it a third time, a fourth time. Francis and I have some teas that we can do 5-6 times at the restaurants we own. But I have to say, the first 15th infusion I ever had was yesterday.
So talk to us about multiple infusions in tea.
Well, I think people often will say, how many infusions can I get out of this? And that's partially, that's something that they have to decide. How much leaf are you using? How quickly are you infusing it? Those are the important things. Eventually, you'll just be drinking water, so it's not that bad. You might just get 3 infusions. You might get 10, you might get 15 infusions from some of the teas that are more complex. And the interesting thing is that the flavor and sort of the whole body of the tea will change over time during these infusions. So you might get an incredible sweetness that comes out after the 6th and 7th infusion, or sort of a plummy character or apricot or something further along. And that's the interesting thing to drink tea in that way.
You know, I think a lot of people, and certainly people who are buying some expensive teas, one of the things they don't realize when they have an oolong tea or one of these expensive whole leaf teas is that I think most Americans toss their tea leaves after one infusion. You know, and one of the things we talked about yesterday was, you know, the oolong tea that I serve right now, my second and third infusions are much more pleasurable than my first infusions. And one of the teas we had with you yesterday, you didn't even let us taste the first infusion. You poured some water over the top, wet the leaves, and poured that water right off.
Right. I was preparing the tea gung-fu style, so using a lot of leaf and very short infusions. So typically, just you want everything as hot as possible. So you heat the teaware, then you do a quick rinse. That hydrates the leaf. And that's really an opportunity to get some information from the aroma. You smell those leaves. You smell the surface of the cup, and that's very enjoyable. Then when you steep the tea, you're going to get much more flavor out.
You know, one of the things that struck me as we were talking earlier about the $300 a pound tea is there's actually tea out there that you could hide your drugs in, and the tea is more expensive than the drugs. Isn't that really turn thing on its head? You could, if you wanted to smuggle your tea in, you could hide it in marijuana.
Exactly.
Not that I have any experience with that. Listen, we're going to take a quick break. We want to come back on the other side, and we're going to talk about two different things. One is we're going to talk about age-worthy teas and how some of these teas last for 50 years, like wine, and how complex and interesting they can get. And we're also going to talk with Sebastian about his travels around the world, because this is a man who puts the boots or the sandals on the ground and goes and finds the tea for us. So stick with us. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys at restaurantguysradio.com.
Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants, and also of The Restaurant Guys Radio Show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to restaurantguysradio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. We're with Sebastian Beckwith. He is leading American Tea Authority. And we had an amazing experience yesterday visiting Sebastian and tasting some of his teas at his shop. These are really teas on the super high end.
Sebastian, I just want to go backwards a little bit, just for some of our people who don't know as much about tea as they'd like to. Now, one of the things that we learned a while back was all tea basically comes from the same bush. But there's lots of different ways that you can treat that bush, and the bush grows in lots of different places and is picked at different times and is in different soils and harvested different ways. And there's a million different ways that we can go from there, correct?
Yes, and I would just talk about the parallels with wine. All wine comes from one grape, different varietals. All the vintners are doing different things. Same with the tea. One plant, the Camilla sinensis plant, a relative of a camellia. Many different varietals and many aspects of terroir, and then craftsmanship in people that make the tea.
Now, you showed us yesterday some pictures of tea plants that were 80 years old and 90 years old. That's certainly not what accounts for the bulk of production in tea, but tell us about the tea plant and how it's harvested and how it works in different cultures in different places.
Sure, and I think that I would just add another zero on some of those plants. 800, 900, 1,000, 2,000 years old are some of the oldest plants in southern China.
Wow.
And the tea plant is indigenous to what's now southern China, Burma, Laos, Assam, India. So that's the region that these old trees are in. These trees eventually led to different varietals that spread across Asia and then to more than 80 countries around the world. But this is also the region where the pu'ers come from, the compressed and aged brick teas.
Talk to us about compressed and aged brick teas. I think these are by the way, pu'ers are probably, Mark, in my favorite category of tea to drink. But talk to us about aging compressed teas.
Okay, let me quickly say that pu'er is a style of tea from this region, and it strictly has to be from this region. They're made from these sort of forest trees or tea plants in the forest. They might be 15 feet high, 10 feet high, and they're semi-managed. These trees are post-fermented. They make a green tea, then they post-ferment or pile-ferment the leaves so that the local biology and mycelium will get involved in the tea, like a sourdough or something, like the yeast that will keep working and changing the tea. And over time, the changes darken, oxidize, ferment the tea, and become more complex, and also mellow the tea. So these are good teas to age, and that's a big business in Yunnan. The aging will make the tea darker. They will either age it as a loose tea or compressed in many different shapes, sort of an inverted nest, a mushroom shape, sort of a flat frisbee shape, or bricks. And depending on where they're aged, the tea will take on a very different character. So they are not held airtight so that the humidity and the local atmosphere can influence the tea.
Wow, that's crazy. And how? So talk to us about how long
might you age a pu'er, and you know what would be a short aging for a pu'er, and what would be considered a long time?
Well, traditionally, there's sort of two types. One is a green style, the sheng, and the other is the shu, which is the black variety. So the green ones would have been aged 15 years, 10, 15, 20 years, and then they would get sort of a maturity, and people would like to drink them, you know, sort of that age. But you could leave it around for 30 years, and it might get better, might stay the same, or it might go down. Just because the tea is older does not mean it's better, and so that's an important thing to take away from this.
Same as wine. I mean, you know, some wine really benefits from aging, and some wine you should have drunk last year, you know?
Right.
But the benefit of having a tea brick like that is you can be drinking it all the time and say, you know, you take a little piece, take a little piece, take a little piece, and you can be sampling that tea all the time, see if it's getting better or maybe has reached its top.
Right, and after Asia sort of got a lot of money and didn't want to have the local products leaving the country, sort of everyone got very interested, and there was a big boom in pu'er in the 2000s, which has dropped a bit now, but it was quite a big bubble, and you would pay many thousands of dollars for one of these cakes from the 1980s or the 1990s or the 1960s.
All right, I'm pretty sure you just told us there was a pu'er bubble that burst.
So how many thousands of dollars would one of these wheels cost? And I mean, we're talking a wheel of how many ounces or grams?
This is 0.8 of a pound, depending. There's a few different weights, but you know, over between a half pound and a pound.
Wow.
And you could pay $1,000 for one from the 1990s, or $3,000 or $5,000, depending on the brick, or up from that.
So yesterday we sampled the pu'er from the 80s. Tell me how much the brick that we tasted.
That's a brick that is I think that was a 500 gram brick, so that's a pound, and that's $300. So that tea will last. It will change over time, and you'll steep it 15 times a serving. So it's actually quite a good deal in terms of monetary outlay.
Well, and when you say 15 times, I mean, you can steep the tea and then save those tea leaves overnight and use it again tomorrow, right?
Yeah, I mean, generally I don't Boston Zone, or I would say you can steep like one afternoon, one morning, or what have you. But with a special tea like this, sometimes you'd make it, stick it in the refrigerator overnight, and then get going again. Tea has a lot of antiviral, antibacterial properties, so I don't think it's much of an issue to do that.
I just think that's I think it's amazing because, you know, it's out of context for me, and I've only come to tea in the last 10 years or so, and I obviously spend my life dealing in, you know, brandies and whiskeys and wines and, you know, $1,000 for a bottle of wine. I mean, we have lots of those in our restaurant, but you know, $1,000 for a 500-gram block of tea is still kind of amazing to me, and I'm fascinated by it, and I'm thrilled that there's a market for it, and I look forward to learning more about it. How did you come to have tea as your passion?
Well, I had just an interest, and I used to work for an adventure travel company in a little country in the Himalayas called Bhutan. And from there, I would travel over to Sikkim through Darjeeling and just started spending time on tea estates and learning from people. And then slowly brought some back for friends and then sort of took the dive and said, all right, I'm going to start a little company. And now we sell on the internet a lot, sort of retail, and we do a lot of hospitality. So we work with a lot of fine dining restaurants. And I travel to Origin a lot and do a lot of educating.
Sebastian, I want to talk to you about serving tea during dinner. I've been a person who drinks hot tea every once in a while throughout my dinner. And Francis has looked at me like I have two heads.
Yeah, like a glass of wine. He'll have a bottle of wine we're working on, and Mark will have a cup of tea going on the side. You say that's a common thing in Asia.
That's a common thing, yeah. People have these different beverages during a meal. In this country, it's so much, you know, do you want tea and coffee with your dessert? Well, the tea pairs very well with some of the foods, or it's just nice to have as a beverage. We did some great tea and cheese pairings. One of the sommeliers there thought did better than with some wines. So you can definitely play around with these things. It is certainly a habit in Hong Kong or in various places in Asia to have the tea right along with the meal.
Yeah, I'm a big fan. I've been doing it literally for my whole life. I mean, my family served tea, you know, four meals a week. We probably had tea during dinner. Can we go backwards for just one second, though, Sebastian, because we've been kind of talking at a kind of a high level on tea here, and I just want to go back and let people know about the different styles of tea that there are and the different kinds of tea that there are, because people see chamomile tea, they see white tea, they see
mint tea,
they see black teas. Can we just kind of straighten that out a little bit for everybody?
Great. For starters, what we've been talking about here is what I would call tea, and it is technically tea. But the herbs, if we were in Europe, they'd be called tisanes or infusions. So these are chamomile, mint, lemon verbena, hibiscus, all very good things to drink, but not technically from the tea plant.
Not made from that specific tea plant. And generally,
right.
And generally have no natural caffeine in them.
Right. There's mate. There's a couple that do have some caffeine, but generally speaking, they are not decaf, they are caffeine-free. They never grew with caffeine. And all tea does have caffeine. We don't sell decaffeinated teas because we don't like what that does to the flavor.
Right.
The process really robs it of the flavor.
And if you're a drinker of decaffeinated tea, if you drink a lot of tea, you know that decaffeinated tea simply doesn't taste like regular tea.
Right. And so I think that the other teas, we have white tea, green tea, oolong tea, black tea, and pu'er tea. So those are the styles. And the white tea is basically picked and air dried. The green tea is picked and then immediately heated, either steamed in Japan or pan fired in the Chinese style.
So it stays green and it will actually be green in color and have a lot more of that kind of, I'll say, chlorophyll-type flavor in your tea.
Exactly. And then the next category is oolong. Oolong is the very wide range between green tea and black tea, and to me is probably the category with the most interesting complexity of flavor. There's a very wide range from high floral, white floral, to more burnt caramel, sugar, fruit, a lot going on with the oolongs. and the most famous ones come from China and Taiwan. And then that leaves us with the black tea, or red tea as they would, as it's known in Asia. And this is English breakfast. It's Ceylon orange pekoe. It's Assam. It's Kimun. It's just the black teas. And then the puer tea is the tea we were discussing earlier, that often in cakes and often aged.
And what makes black teas black?
It's just really the enzymatic oxidation. So think of picking up some basil leaves in the morning and bruising them or hitting them with a knife and leaving them on your counter and coming back at nighttime. That they've turned brown and they've turned black, and that's really the process that makes the tea.
Well, I'll tell you, Sebastian, I had such an education yesterday, and I went in knowing a little something about tea, and I came out knowing a lot of something about tea, and more humbled than ever about what I don't
say,
know
I,
about
I came
tea.
In, I came in realizing how little I knew about tea.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I
feel the same way. There's a lot more to learn. It's pretty endless with tea.
Well, you can find out more about tea and about Sebastian's company, In Pursuit of Tea. If you're in the restaurant business and you want to sort of up your tea game, or if you have a retail shop and you want to up your tea game, you can reach out to him at inpursuitoftea.com, and I recommend it highly. Sebastian, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on the Heritage Radio Network and on restaurantguysradio.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, The Restaurant Guys. I have to say, you're the tea guy in this relationship. I'm the coffee guy in this relationship.
Please stop calling it a relationship. You're bothering me.
It's a relationship. I was fascinated yesterday by these teas. Can I be honest with you?
No, why?
All right. No, I will be honest with you.
Yeah.
And I know this is shallow of me, but when you tell me that something's $500 a pound for this little brick of it, I'm like, huh? What? What's that about?
Yeah.
And you know what? And then when you pour it for me and I don't quite get it, I remember my first sip of beer. I was 5. My dad drove a truck for Ryan Goldberg Company. I remember when I first had wine. I remember when I first had coffee, and I was like, you know, I don't get it, but some people, they see stuff in here that I don't see, and it makes me crazy, and I have to learn everything about it.
That's really funny.
And
when I had and one of the reasons I don't drink coffee is because when I had coffee, I was like, I don't like this.
Yeah.
So I didn't drink it.
Do you know when I first had coffee? I was pushing carriages in my first legal job when I was 16 years old. You know, I did papers before that, and I had an illegal job in a sandwich shop because my dad was like, oh, you're having some free time? Get a job! And that was a very good thing that he did. And so after cutting onions in the – my first job was a restaurant job after Paperboy. Did I ever tell you this?
No.
Sandwiches Unlimited for Mr. Polito in Livingston.
Excellent.
I'm 15 years old.
I've had sandwiches from you. It's good you left that field.
Oh, no. I wasn't allowed to make the sandwiches. They were. I remember the first day I went in, Mr. Polito had been my music teacher, and he also opened a sandwich shop. So he illegally hired me underage to work in the sandwich shop. But, hey, what the heck? He's not around anymore, so I can tell that story. And it was great. And he was a great guy. And
probably
he's,
statute of limitations.
He's a good boss. Yeah,
too.
Probably, yeah. That's how old I am. So, but I remember he's like, okay, well, now it's time to cut the tomatoes. And I'm like, cut the tomatoes? And he brings in 5 or 6 boxes of tomatoes, and there's the slicer in the back. Which I'm pretty sure I wasn't supposed to be touching.
I'm pretty sure you weren't supposed to be touching.
But it was in the back room. I wasn't allowed to touch the slicer in the front room where everybody could see. So I'm slicing the tomatoes. And I was like, all right, that's not so bad. It's like, all right, here you go. Here's the lettuce. Brings in 5 boxes of lettuce on the slicer. I'm like, okay. He's like, now here's a big one. And he hands me, I swear to God, a World War II surplus gas mask with the canister on the thing. I'm like, what's that for? Onions. Onions are next. It was in a windowless back room with the slicer. I'm underage to be using a slicer, and I've got a gas mask on from World War II that probably worked right up through the Korean War, but wasn't working in 1977 or whatever the hell I was using it. And it was, I would just slice and slice, and everything's burning, and I would go into a walk-in box and stare into the cold air blowing out of the blower.
Just a couple tricks for onions for anybody who doesn't know. A cold onion will give you a lot less onion face.
Mm.
The other thing you can do is a trick, and I don't know why it works, is to cut onions next to running water.
Interesting.
That will help the onion from getting in your eyes.
And the other trick is you cut an onion laterally from top to bottom in half, and then you leave the root on. And if you leave the root on and don't cut that until the very last, it will bleed a lot less and you will cry a lot less. But that leads to my first legal job, which was at ShopRite. And I was pushing carriages in the cold in a snowstorm in March. And in the break room, the only thing that was free was coffee. And I didn't like the first warm cup of coffee, but it was warm, and it was a beverage, and it was free. And that's how I developed a taste for Maxwell House. And it went on from there.
So you know the irony, and Francis knows the irony of this. My first job, as well, was collecting carriages at a ShopRite.
Interesting. I did know that.
Way back when. Except when I went to the break room and I had coffee, I said, I hate this. And then I got a cup of tea, and, well, I drank it. And I liked it.
I didn't know that, actually. I really didn't know that.
Absolutely.
My ShopRite didn't have tea.
Yeah.
The world could have been a different place.
My ShopRite had Lipton tea.
Really? Yeah. Interesting. That's the same tea that my grandmother carried in her purse. I love you, Nana. That was great, but you were cheap. Anyway, well, I hope you guys have enjoyed the hour as much as we have. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys on the Heritage Radio Network and restaurantguysradio.com.